Some years ago, I started gathering material for a book, which has not yet been completed, on the philosophy of art as impulse and impact. And it is more or less along the lines of the research for this work that we wish to present our case this morning. First, however, I think it would be generally useful to recognize a certain essential difference between the intellectual and emotional life of the human being. We have a common belief or popular opinion that man is governed largely by his intellect. In actual experience, in the daily process of contact with other human beings, we gradually realize that this is not true. Most of the faults which we attribute to the mind arise actually within the involved and complicated structure of man's emotions. The emotional content in man's psychic nature is far older than his mental content. The mind seems to attain the estate of a conditioned state of the emotions. And that which is accomplished by the mind is always directed and dominated by the pressures of the emotions. Thus, when we say something about an individual, presumably disparaging to his mind, we nearly always are actually attacking his emotions, although we really do not understand or appreciate this fact. For example, when we say an individual is selfish, we may be referring to something in his philosophy, but we are actually accusing his emotions. When we say he is dogmatic, it is the same. When we say he is narrow-minded, it generally means that he is bigoted, and bigotry is an emotional pressure. When we say that he is arrogant, this is emotion. Ambitious, also emotion. Fearful, belligerent. When we say even that he is argumentative, we are largely telling others and ourselves that under the pressure of emotional excitation, he unreasonably defends his point of view. All of these pressures are in themselves emotional forces, coloring, conditioning, specializing, and to a degree perverting the natural course of thought. Let us also realize that while we may say that a person is an intellectualist, we are really hardly appreciating our own remarks. A person who is a complete intellectual, it would be as difficult to discover as a person complete in any other respect. Actually, if it would be hypothetically possible to discover an individual completely and entirely dominated by his mind, and this mind in complete rulership over his life, we would have a person in a state of complete and entire non-action. In other words, he might not be any good to anyone, but so far as his mind is concerned, he could not be of any harm to anyone. Because he would live completely in a non-energized state. He might spend his whole life adding two and two together and making four. He might have certain theorems which were inflexible and inevitable, but he would recite them tonelessly, without meaning, without purpose, without reason. He would simply be a completely thinking creature. But if he was a full and entire intellectualist, he would be thinking without motive. And to think without a reason for thinking, without some dominant purpose, is unthinkable in itself. So why does he think? He thinks because he wishes to gratify some emotion, some instinct, some attitude. If his business is an intellectual business, He may be thinking in order to supply the needs of his family, which in turn satisfies his emotional content. If he is an explorer or discoverer, he may be thinking in hope of fame, of distinction, of becoming outstanding, victorious, of being a pioneer. All of these emotional pressures. Or perhaps he may be thinking in order to be of service to others, to advance the general state of knowledge, for patriotic reasons. He may be thinking because he believes that the work he is doing is of signal importance to others. But the moment he states the fact, "I believe that what I am doing is important," he is on the level of emotion. So that the pure and complete intellectualist is just about unthinkable. He cannot exist because he can do nothing unless he is pressed to this accomplishment by some feeling, by some desire, some aspiration or ambition. In other words, he must have energy. And the energy for thought is all supplied by emotion. And without this energizing factor, the thought itself is meaningless. Therefore, in practical experience, man uses his mind principally to sustain his emotional purposes, to achieve their fulfillment, and for various emotional satisfactions within himself. Now, in the ancient Greek psychology and symbolism, all of the arts and sciences were personified as the muses. And the muses were all female figures, although they had rulership over the most exact intellectual departments of life. And above them all, and superior to them all, as the principle of wisdom itself, was Pallas Athena, also a feminine deity, as the complete embodiment or personification of wisdom itself. Thus these ancient people seem to have recognized that the entire emotional pattern, the emotional pressure in man, is the cause and the nourisher and the sustainer of what we call intellect. Now, in the field of arts, which are, of course, under the patronage of great muses, according to the classical way of looking at these matters, we come into a world of inspirational values. Arts are essentially emotional expressions. And in the case of the arts, rather than in that of the sciences, an art differs from a science primarily in the dominance of its pure emotional content. A science is a form of knowledge that has been integrated and organized to the degree that it has been placed upon an experimental basis. And on this basis, certain causes set in motion always and inevitably produce certain results. Therefore, we consider the sciences to be the most exact forms of human knowledge. The arts, however, spring not from these exactitudes primarily, although many arts, because of their involvements in sciences, finally become highly accurate, as in the case of music. Arts in themselves are expressions. Expressions sustained by a universal admiration rather than by some exact formula of acceptances. Admiration itself is a highly emotional state, but represents one of the most sublime, altruistic, and unselfish of man's emotional forces. Art has been cultivated from the beginning of time, and we often come to mistaken ideas about arts as well as about other forms of learning. We can see, perhaps least abstractly, that someone somewhere sat down and discovered art. Such is not the case. Art is a universal appreciation that is released through man and has been since the beginning of time. There have been many artists, but no human being has ever dominated art, has ever been able to capture art and hold it and to separate it from the lives of other persons. Art is therefore a universal force, a powerful ministering agent in the life of the human being. The primary manifestation of art as we know it was the art of release. The individual became an artist through the gradual determination arising within himself to place the mark of himself upon other things around him and to gradually organize his environment into a symbol or likeness of his own nature and instinct. Art, therefore, according to the Neoplatonists and to many other mystical groups, represented man's effort to play God. It was his effort to place upon his world the mark of a higher order of understanding or a greater integration of beauty than was otherwise possible. The Hermetic axiom, therefore, reads, "Art perfects nature." The artist in any field, therefore, is one who was attempting to aid and assist the natural operations of the universe, or to make these operations more manifest, more obvious to others, in order that others might, through this realization, worship or understand or appreciate more fully. Man cannot actually, of himself, improve upon the divine plan. But this plan, working upon nature and through nature over vast periods of time, has produced out of itself certain apprentices or beings possessing power to cooperate with nature, either through understanding, through admiration, through inspiration, or intuition. Thus, all that the artist is doing is revealing nature, or cooperating with nature in the release of nature's own ways, purposes, and patterns. It was therefore of an early time that man conceived himself to be a gardener in a great world garden. It was not his privilege to bestow life. He could not give life to the seeds in the earth. He could not require the harvest. He could not, by a wave of his hand or a magic wand, cause the desert to blossom as a rose. Nature had to do these wonders, but man could help. Man could bring water to the desert so that it might blossom. Man could weed the garden so that the good plants and the purposed growth could have an opportunity. Man could also arrange the flowering and planted things in patterns peculiarly pleasing to himself, and therefore, to his estimation, pleasing to everyone else. Man was also able to encourage the life of growing things by supplying them a suitable environment, by keeping them well fertilized, by keeping the soil soft and cultivated above them. Thus, man could help. He could not bestow life, but he could conserve it. He could direct it and aid it. He could do for all things in nature that which theoretically he would like to do for his own child. Bring these things into maturity with less difficulty than they would otherwise experience. So art became the handmaiden of the law. It became an instrument by which the works of the eternal were revealed to man, by man, in a more sublime and wonderful way. Art as architecture began building magnificent shrines and temples to man's worship. Art as music brought the great masses and the wonderful litanies to the church and to all phases of man's aesthetic enjoyment. Art, even in such fields as astronomy and psychology, brought wonderful revelations of the universe. But art, most of all, produced a tremendous impact upon persons beholding it, or those coming immediately or directly under its influence. Thus, in man himself, art is impulse. It is his own release of the patterns divine and human that are locked within his own soul. Art as impact is the reaction of this tremendous revelation upon other persons who receive into themselves a strong and pressured and conditioned reflex as the result of artistry as it is expressed through great creative ability. We often wonder who taught the great artists. We know, for example, that these artists had their schools and workshops where they instructed others. But who taught them? Who taught Michelangelo and Leonardo, Raphael and Titian, Rembrandt and Van Dyck? They dominated the schools of their times, and while they may, some of them, have had some instruction from other masters, we know that they did, they so excelled that instruction that they became dominant figures in the world of art and became teachers, even though we cannot remember that they were ever students. This means, in some way, that these human beings were in rapport with a certain level of beauty within themselves and had the magnificent coordination of emotions and faculties and powers by means of which they were able to express this creative aptitude or creative impulse in a manner suitable to excite the profound respect and veneration of those around them. So art comes to us out of the human being. It is something that the artist must do. It is something that he must give into, accept, and recognize that he is dedicated to this particular activity. Thus, for him, art is a natural expression, and it loses its value only if he, as an individual, is not so emotionally constituted. If he is learning art merely in order to make a living, if he is training a mediocre talent in order that he may have certain personal satisfaction, then actually he is not a great artist. But if this art bursts through from within himself as a pressure which he cannot resist and which he must live to fulfill through his own action, then we are in the presence of the potential of artistic excellence and in the shadow of a great genius. The average person is not a genius in any art, but still he has art requirement within his own life and nature. And therefore, just as surely as every part of the human personality must be brought into constructive expression if health and happiness are to be enjoyed, so each person, to some degree and in some measure, must express himself through creative artistry of some kind. Where this is completely blocked, where the individual is not permitted to manifest this dimension of his own psychic life, he is impoverished. The more so, and especially so, because the natural structure of the psyche itself is art. And as the Greeks and Egyptians so well pointed out, the release of the beautiful through man is the release of his own soul. If, therefore, he is deficient in this release, or has never found some way to express these creative instincts within his own nature, he is definitely impoverished, and the probability of normalcy for him is thereby reduced. This is especially important because the pressures by which we become psychotic, the pressures by which our internal life may be seriously disturbed, with most disrupting results upon our physical body, these pressures are from the emotional level, or from the level of the arts. Therefore, the art instinct and the mastery of the concept of art is, to a certain degree, an emotional discipline. It is a discipline by which the emotions find constructive, reasonable outlets and are thereby prevented from unreasonable attitudes and activities. So we will consider first art in its nature as impulse, the impulse of the individual to reveal himself. He will not perhaps define this as self-revelation. He may think that he is revealing a cosmic quality through his own nature. But actually, art is the individual's own psychic integration or entity moving out into expression along lines of beauty and release. If, therefore, we consider this matter carefully, we realize that there are many arts which can be practiced to the benefit of the person. These arts may include any way by which man releases himself. Whereas the most of our so-called intellectual attainments are those of accumulation. Therefore, accumulations are static until they are vitalized by a dynamic within us. And whatever our mental accumulations may be, they depend upon our internal psychic stimulation for their usefulness, for their application in spheres of specialized endeavor. Therefore, the individual, no matter how learned he may become, remains static, remains comparatively impotent and sterile until his own aesthetic or artistic soul ensouls his reason, gives purpose and direction to his intellect, and causes him to be a creature with purpose. So purpose comes from this psychic integration. A man's purpose is no truer, no wiser, no better than the degree of wakefulness which has been attained within his own soul. The soul which is awake purposes the mind to constructive action. The soul which is not awake, which is not matured, which has not oriented and integrated itself, cannot bestow this purpose, so that the intellectual and material lives of the person become sterile. How then can we express these creative instincts within our own natures? Usually first by recognizing that they are necessary. And this necessity has been clearly brought to our attention in recent developments along psychological lines. We know, for instance, the present technique of asking those under treatment for various ailments to draw, paint, sketch, or variously make pictures of their own pressures, or to make pictures without any obvious or conscious purpose, recognizing that gradually the psychic pressure in the individual will take over and cause the picture to become a representation of his own need. This is one of the important modern forms of diagnosis. And as diagnosis is two-thirds of the remedy, you can recognize its importance. It is further important because the patient himself, consciously and objectively, cannot usually give this diagnosis. He may be questioned repeatedly, but because of the highly conditioned pressures of a neurosis within him, he is unable to indicate the cause of his own trouble. Therefore, it is usually easier for this cause to be revealed than defined. And through the expressions of his own creativeness, this cause is revealed. Now let us pause for just a second and generalize this, because it is important to us today. Statistics available and studies made in recent years indicate that to the degree that we find rising pressures of psychic intensity, we find lowering standards of aesthetic achievement among a people. For example, today, we are comparatively without aesthetic integration. As a result of that, we are the most miserable people, probably, in the history of the last 1,000 years. We find that to the degree that our minds and our emotions become locked on levels of utility, we begin to get sick. We observe also today less and less appreciation for what might be termed pure art values. We find even the artist himself utterly confused. We find him torn between his emotions, the emotions of sincerity and the emotions and the emotion of profit. We find him compromising his own God-given talents in the effort to please persons without ability or discrimination, and thus be a successful artist. We find also that in most arts today, there is a dominant confusion. We blame the artist. We sometimes blame the critic. But the one person we do not blame and should blame is ourselves. We can and could easily change this situation by a distinct stand as human beings. We can demand what we wish, and we will get that which we demand. Our own indifference, our own uncertainty and confusion upon an emotional level, all these prevent us from a clear statement of our own desires or a clear conscience for the support of that which we honestly and naturally believe to be right. While this confusion exists, we will have the present difficulties. The average home today in America has little, if any, consideration for art. Beyond perhaps a rather superficial effort to make a pleasant or colorful environment. I was talking to a man not long ago who had furnished an apartment. It seemed to me that his brand new overstuffed set was a little out of place in the pattern. The rest of it was not bad, but this sort of didn't look quite the way it should. So I asked him, I said, how did you happen to pick that particular shape and that particular upholstery? Well, he says, I'll tell you. I really didn't like it myself, but I got it for $49 off. And to a degree, $49 off, or buying it wholesale, or 10% discount to the trade, determines more or less our environments today. Obviously, we must economize. But if our instincts were as strong on an aesthetic level as they are on the level of our economy, we probably would search a little longer and finally discover at the same economy something that was suitable. But we do not think it through that far. We do not realize that we live within a pattern that is forever moving in upon us. And that to the degree that this pattern is not thoughtfully arranged and not well integrated, it will and does have a detrimental effect upon our own living and thinking. Very often we become so accustomed to this detriment that we lose sight of it entirely and are only reminded of it when we discover that the environment, no longer as furniture and fixtures, but as what we like to term home, is not especially attractive to us. We find that the atmosphere, or the psychological level of home consciousness, becomes more and more deficient. And we do not know what to blame, or who to blame, for the nervousness, the edginess, the lack of compatible understanding which springs up in these environments. A good many of these problems are simply due to these environments, which have not been properly considered and have not been arranged with a due regard for artistry, for the creation of a setting that not only satisfies the individual, but is to a degree a stimulation upon him for further progress. Sometimes his environment is a little better than he is. This is good, because it will make him stretch and grow. But if his environment is less ordered than himself, then it will inspire him only to a decline, or will impel him to lose something that he has already achieved in the form of character integration. We can say, of course, that the individual would naturally choose to be surrounded by that which is expressive of his own nature. Therefore, is it possible for an environment to be inconsistent with the person living in it? It would not be possible if man was aggressively an individual, in the sense of taking a dynamic attitude toward things. But as he moves about from one rented apartment to another, as he gradually moves what furnishings he has into one environment after another, he gradually loses domination over his own patterns. He becomes accustomed to things which are not really pleasing to him. And becoming thus accustomed, he loses the keenness of his own insight. And once he has dulled this, once he has denied himself, or perhaps denied himself many times, he is capable of creating an environment that is inconsistent with his own nature. If his nature is strong and insistent, however, he will gradually and relentlessly change this environment. And perhaps that is one of the reasons why so many people move today from one place to another. They are dissatisfied with the highly stylized, highly mechanized, highly materialistic efficiency of establishments. There is no longer any life, any individuality, any dynamic, and the individual becomes bored and seeks some other escape mechanism, often of a destructive nature. Another particular specialization within this is the gradual disappearance of art in the term of efficiency. And we have one or two points to make on this subject. And that is the comparison between the Rococo furnishings of the 19th century and the streamlining of the 20th. Essentially, the value does not lie in these two arbitrary definitions. Probably if the truth were known, the simplicity of modern furnishing is in many respects an advantage over the older, involved, complicated mass of dust catchers that plagued the last century. There is no question but that simplicity has dynamic, if that simplicity is good. But all simplicity is not good, any more than we can say that all complication is bad. There must be a certain artistic or aesthetic integration. And where the natural and basic furnishings of a modern home are extremely geometrical, having practically no obvious ornamentation, depending either upon the color of natural woods or things of that nature, for their cleanness of line, and depending very heavily upon mathematical proportion, for their satisfaction within the consciousness of the individual. We have, perhaps, in the house today, a series of excellent foundations, excellent pedestals for the use of the individual in creating his own artistry. Against these neutral backgrounds of geometric structure, the individual is capable of expressing his own foreground interests. And therefore, it becomes even more critical for him to decide how he shall enrich and how he shall ennoble and bring warmth to these austerities. Because austerity in itself is neither a vice nor a virtue. But on the level of art, it is always encouraging the individual to bestow something from himself to enrich and ennoble it. Thus, where we have these highly traditional, highly conventional forms as we have them today, there is nearly always a pressing demand for the presence of well-chosen, highly integrated art. And we have made an interesting discovery namely that these very simple household designs with which we are becoming more and more familiar are extremely neutral and give opportunity for the mingling of art schools in a manner not possible under the more highly complicated forms of traditional furnishing and fixture. When you had a Louis XIV chair or a Jacobean sideboard, you were more or less forced to build around these dominant pieces a compatible atmosphere. And little by little, you became a traditionalist in furnishing. Today, however, there is no such stylization. If anything, modern furnishing is moving gradually toward certain Oriental schools. And I believe that the Japanese home furnishing concept has taken a deep and powerful hold on the American imagination. In any way, the simplicity of the present furnishing makes it possible to blend with it almost any form of artistry which is pleasant, happy, and compatible to the owner of the establishment. We thus have today a wonderful opportunity in the home of blending East and West as schools of ornamentation and artistry. We will find that in the modern home, with its most tailored and most highly specialized furnishings, that Oriental art is most effective, that Greek art is effective, that Egyptian art is effective, that the fine old masters of Europe, the Gothic art, all of these fit magnificently, and they work together in an astonishing way, so that the person is perfectly able to bring together and even mingle many schools of appreciation. These schools give him a warmth, give him an understanding, and give him great opportunity to reveal his own nature. It is therefore rather depressing to find that the majority of individuals do not accept the challenge offered by these things. They are satisfied with mediocrity in the form of a lamp and a pair of bookends. They are not inspired to fulfill the challenge of these wonderful pedestals upon which the individual could place the objects of his own understanding. Thus we have great need for artistry today to help to build better homes, better families. But while the utilities may be supplied by firms and houses specializing in these things, they must be arranged into a highly personal pattern by a dominant individuality. Speaking of dominant individualities, I know a very wealthy man in this community who tells me that he has never been in his own front parlor because he is overwhelmed by it. He didn't furnish it himself. It was a sort of a family deal. And when it was all finished in its lavishness and its splendor and its magnificence, the poor man had an inferiority complex every time he went in. In other words, he was completely dominated. He had no sense of being able to create something himself within this environment. It just moved in upon him. And this can happen also if we believe all it says in the books on furnishing. That we should like this, that we must appreciate that, and that we are a little better than morons if we do not choose a certain type of thing. All these pressures prevent the individual from being himself. And perhaps they save him while he has no self that he wishes to express. But if he has a dynamic, he should release into his environment, fulfilling the things which he believes to be necessary for his own peace, happiness, and intellectual moral security. So much of that field, and we go into others. In the field of artistry, we've already discussed the problem of music in a lecture which we gave on the last program, so we will not emphasize that phase today, other than to point out the same rules apply. and that the selection of a musical life, now greatly enriched and made more dynamic by the high developments of fidelity and things of that nature in good music, that this in turn becomes a challenge on the life of the individual to choose that which is appropriate to his own consciousness and to try at the same time and grow. So we will emphasize especially this morning that type of art most generally associated with the term, and that is painting and sculpting. And we will try to understand the problem as the individual experiences it. The individual naturally progresses from within himself in terms of symbolism. Every human being who has any kind of a psychic integration is instinctively a symbolist. From the time when he doodles on the telephone pad to the time that he becomes another Michelangelo, he is a symbolist. He is forever releasing or expressing or exposing something from within himself. Now, a great many persons are not skilled artists. And in a great number also, the instinct to art is not strong enough to dominate other instincts. If this instinct is not strong, it can seldom, if ever, be transformed by learning into genius. But it can be, to a certain degree, released into a condition of pleasant cooperation in living. To simply say, I can't draw a straight line and then lose all interest in art, is to defeat ourselves. We may not be able to draw a straight line, but did you ever realize that neither can nature? There is not a straight line in the universe. Therefore, this does not become so serious a defect as some individuals conceive. There is a rudiment of artistry in the individual that can be released to some degree. When we give children music lessons, there is not one person in 10,000 who has any expectancy that his prodigy will ever achieve greatly on the level of professional music. But we have always felt that music was a civilizing force in the life of the young and in the life of the old even also, even though the process of attaining it may approach barbarism at times. So we go through this procedure, fully convinced that it will ultimately have a maturing effect upon the soul. Today, with the greater increase in leisure, with working hours shorter, with nearly every problem of life brought more and more under an extraordinary efficiency, the possibility of the individual devoting some part of his life to the natural expression of himself should loom strong on the horizon of man's affairs. It is perfectly conceivable that everyone can find some form of artistry by which he will be able to increase his own personality integration. Now, one thing that has been held against art and against nearly all avocational artistic interests is that they have a tendency to divide families. The individual with a hobby devotes time to that hobby which other members of the family wish to have devoted to themselves. This is true where there's only one hobbyist in the family. But experience has proved to us that the individual who objects to the hobby is usually the one most in need of one. Because he has none of his own, or he would take the other person's time in which they are engaged in hobbies as a wonderful opportunity to advance his own. But if he has none and is depending totally and completely upon the physical association of someone else, then it can become a highly competitive problem. But there is a hobby in which both families and homes can work together on an artistic level, and that is the home itself, making it a more complete expression of a harmonic integrity of human life. But everyone today needs avocational outlets, especially on an artistic or aesthetic level. And if it does not happen that he is able to paint or draw, it may well be that he can have the craft shop or the loom or something whereby he becomes creative. Now this brings us to the keynote of the whole situation on the level of art, namely the frustration of the individual to be creative.